Thank you very much, Ed, for that very nice introduction. So far as the Philadelphia Society is concerned, I'm sure all of us here believe in private property. And if there's anybody who doesn't think that the Philadelphia Society is a private property of Don Lipson, he doesn't have a proper appreciation of private property and is therefore fundamentally disqualified from being a member of the Philadelphia Society. I had completely forgotten those long past days in 1964 when the Philadelphia Society was founded. I may say I have enormously enjoyed my contacts with Bill Buckley ever since, particularly on the ski slopes. He's better than I am, but still. But the thing that it brought to mind was the enormous change that there has been in the intellectual atmosphere since we met at that hotel in New York. Go back to the Goldwater year of 1964. I was a visiting professor for that year at Columbia University, so I happened to be in New York, and they had an extremely hard time finding any other intellectual in New York who was willing to stand up and say he was in favor of Barry Goldwater. As a result of which, I had an extraordinary opportunity to be in touch with all of the various groups in New York, because for about the month before the election, I spent most of my time going around from one group to another, from the financial journalist group to the foundation people to the academic group to the church groups, you name them. I spoke to all of them. And I was fascinated at that time by the impression I received of the extraordinary homogeneity of the intellectual atmosphere in New York. It explained to me why it was that those few people who were exceptions in New York, people like Ludwig von Mises, who was at that time in a very adjunct basis at New York University, why they were kind of kooks over there. They were regarded as not quite in the right mind. They weren't in the swim. But I was also impressed with what a pushover the New Yorkers were when it came to these arguments. They had never heard a reasonable justification for the kind of position that Barry Goldwater was taking. It didn't occur to them that there could be a reasonable justification. They had talked to one another. They had set up straw men. They had found all the silly answers, and they were able to dismiss these things right off the hand, but they had never heard a real argument. And they didn't have any answer to the real arguments. They were, in that sense, pushovers. Now, I think you will agree that the atmosphere today has moved a little, not so much in New York, but around the rest of the country. New York remains a very backward area in this respect. I see some New Yorkers here. Ernest Vandenhaag can testify to whether I am wrong in my description. I'm not so up to date. Have they improved any? A little. Yes, I think that's right. I think a Lou Lehrman would not have made the kind of progress he did in 1964. And the fact that he can make the progress he did testifies to the fact that even if the intellectual climate hasn't changed, the climate of opinion among the public at large has changed very drastically. So that in a way brings me to the subject that I was going to talk about tonight. I think we have a tendency, all of us, to get carried away by the short-term situation, by what's going on this year, by the current election, by the current developments, and that it is important for us from time to time to step back and take a much longer point of view. And what I had thought I would talk about tonight was that much longer point of view, which is to some extent, suggested by this contrast between the intellectual climate of the country when Goldwater was running for president and the intellectual climate when Ronald Reagan ran for president in 1980. There was a tremendous change between those two dates. Ronald Reagan, of course, got his political start as a national figure in that marvelous speech he made for Goldwater in 1964. But Goldwater's defeat in 1964 was overwhelming. Reagan's victory in 1980 was also overwhelming. That was partly accident. I have no doubt that if you go back to the 1964 episode, The assassination of Kennedy established a political climate which was very unfavorable to a Goldwater. If Kennedy had lived, the 1964 campaign would have been between Goldwater and Kennedy, and it would have been a much different kind of a campaign. It would have been conducted on, at least one half of it would have been conducted on a higher level. But as it was a very difficult situation, and I think that was a very special feature, which made it was almost impossible, I think, under the sort of attitudes of the time, for almost anybody to have defeated the successor to John F. Kennedy, particularly someone like Lyndon Johnson, who was willing to play the game the way he was willing to play it. In 1980, undoubtedly, there was an adventitious circumstance that the opponent was Jimmy Carter. And that helped a great deal and certainly added to the change in intellectual climate. But even if you allow for all those special circumstances, there was a very real change in the attitudes and beliefs. And what I think what I would like to talk about is really these long-term trends and where we are and what the future is likely to hold for us. I am sure many of you in this room, like myself, are great admirers of what I regard as one of the great classics of all time, A.V. Dicey's book on law and public opinion in the 19th century, in which he points out that trends in public opinion tend to go in very long swings, that they tend to develop a momentum of their own as they go, that when they're in full power, almost nothing can stand in their way. They'll roll over anything. But that as they develop, countercurrents develop. Sooner or later, these countercurrents reach a maximum, you have a sort of an uncertain position. And it's only at such times that you can get significant changes in the actual course of events. And he stressed in there the tendency for the actual course of events to follow some 20 years or so behind the changes in the intellectual climate of opinion. His position really predated that famous quotation from Keynes that is repeated over and over again, whereby he says the politicians today are listening to some long-dead economists and other philosophers, but of course only economists count. Keynes and I would have agreed on that. What I want to do is to trace out what I believe these long-term trends have been for the last almost 200 years and where we are now. Because I think there is more reason to be optimistic about the long-run possibilities ahead of us than one might gather from the short-run situation. I think at the moment we're at a very low point. I think for a variety of reasons I won't go into, though this 1980 election has been very much of a backward step on the right road. We've sort of had a very real setback. I don't think there's any doubt, arising out of the unemployment situation, the recession we've been going through. And I am not too optimistic whether we will be able to consolidate the progress that was made in 1981 or whether we are going to slip farther back on the wrong road. But I think that's taking much too short time a point of view. If you take the kind of broad view I'm looking at, you have to recognize that in these times that Dicey talked about, when there was cross currents of opinion were at a maximum, you have a very unsettled state in which things don't work themselves out right away. They go back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, and finally, after an interval, a new direction emerges, and when that direction gets going, that trend gets going, it's almost unstoppable for a while, until it sets up countercurrents. The first of these major trends that I want to talk about started really in the world of ideas with Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations in 1776, the man we've all got on our ties thanks to Don Lipsett's clever commercial promotion. Free advertisement, Don. He'll give me a free tie in return, so there is no free advertisement. But Adam Smith, Wealth of Nations, marked a distinct change in intellectual attitudes. It took a very long time before that affected policy. It didn't affect policy fundamentally. It didn't really reach its fruition until you had the repeal of the Corn Laws about 70 years later. But it did take place. And most of the 19th century was a century which represented a carrying out in policy of those ideas that Adam Smith had favored, the ideas of free markets, of laissez-faire, of minimal government. Now, the interesting thing to me about these developments is that they are worldwide. They're not restricted to one country. They're not parochial. Governments have been very successful at times in interfering with the flow of goods and the flow of people. But they have never been able to interfere fundamentally with the flow of ideas. Sooner or later, and generally sooner rather than later, ideas are contagious and go across boundaries and influence everybody. And you can see this if you take the 19th century episode. The real impact of the laissez-faire ideas was not at all restricted to Great Britain. The U.S., of course, was another place where it was carried over very much. It's true, Alexander Hamilton wrote his report on manufacturers, which was intended to be a criticism of Adam Smith's doctrine and demonstrating that it didn't apply to the United States. It's true the United States did have tariffs and departed from the pure doctrine. But it's also true that you had a great era of laissez-faire in the United States, particularly after the Civil War. You really didn't have the Adam Smith doctrine effective in the United States. Well, it first became effective really after the 1830s when you had many state governments around the country that engaged in what we today would call socialist ventures. State of Illinois setting up and owning commercial banks. Indiana having a whole collection of state banks. Canals, railroads. You had a very large, widespread era of state socialism. And this time state, I mean U.S. states, capital S, not state equal government. But most of them went broke in the panic of 1837, and that ended that era and really laid the groundwork for a very long era of essential laissez-faire. But I think an even more interesting example, and one I've referred to on many occasions, was the case of Japan. In 1867, you had the Meiji Restoration in Japan, in which a young group of upstart nobility took over. They had no interest in free markets as a matter of principle. They had no interest in democracy from a political point of view. They had one interest and one interest only, and that was to make Japan into a great world power, into a great country. But what policy did they follow? Well, without even thinking about it, they immediately followed the British policies of capitalism, of free markets. They agreed on a treaty with Britain, which prevented them from imposing a tariff of more than 5% for 30 years, so that their early stages of development were entirely free trade. The government did get involved to some extent in the steel industry and shipbuilding, but in the main, you had essentially a free market development. It was facilitated by the way in which they converted from serfdom by buying off the daimus of the feudal lords with government bonds, and the feudal lords proceeded to take much of that and invest it in industry as a way of getting some capital going. But in the main, you had a free market development. I think it's a dramatic illustration of the effect of the leading ideas of an epoch around the world. Along about the end of the 19th century, these countercurrents that Dicey refers to started to grow and grew very rapidly. The intellectual tide of opinion started changing in Britain around 1870s, 1880s, with the emergence of Fabian socialism and the ideas of that the There were many evils that the market system left, which there certainly were, and that the right way to attack them was through government. And I would say that that set in motion in the intellectual world a period of some 75, 80 years of a long-term trend toward governmental control, toward centralized government. That trend, again, took 20, 25, 30 years before it was manifested in actual policy. It was manifested in policy in Great Britain before World War I, in the unemployment insurance, the old age benefits, and so on. One of the most fascinating documents I know is Dicey's preface to the 1913 edition of Law and Public Opinion. I may say Law and Public Opinion was originally given as lectures at Harvard in 1899. And it was then published in its first edition, I think about 1902 or 3 when it had been polished up. But there was a second edition in 1913 in which Dicey added a preface, a very, very long preface, which is a fascinating document because he predicts in that preface, before World War I, the future trends of policy in Great Britain with extraordinary accuracy, and which makes it very clear that the emergence of Fabian socialism and the welfare state in Britain was not a consequence of the effect of World War I or World War II, but was fundamentally a consequence of the following out of these ideas of the Fabian socialists and their associates. Now, that era of a move toward welfare states, toward collectivism, again lasted about 75, 80, 85 years, and again was absolutely worldwide. It didn't hit, it hit the United States intellectuals before and during World War I and during the 1920s. By 1929, the intellectual climate in American campuses was almost wholly socialist. The New Republic, The Nation, which were the sort of publications of this Fabian socialist idea, were the leading publications on college campuses. The Socialist Party was the leading party of the academics and the intellectuals. The Socialist Party platform, as we pointed out in our book, Free to Choose, of 1928, has been completely adopted in the period since then. I have always said that the Socialist Party was the most influential political party in the United States in the first 50 years of this century. Not because it elected anybody to office, but because it was part of the process by which this revolution of ideas, this trend of ideas, was carried out. And that, as I say, that trend of ideas really came to fruition in the United States after the New Deal in 1933, after the Great Depression, when you had the major change in public opinion, when you had a shift in public attitudes away from regarding the state and government as an umpire and toward regarding government and the state as a big brother who was going to solve all the problems. But it was the same trend that Britain had shown some 20, 30 years earlier. But again, these same ideas really underlay the Russian Revolution, the form which it took in 1918 when you had the Russia go communist. These same ideas of Fabian socialist spread everywhere around the world. And again, a very interesting example, and one I like to cite because of its extraordinary parallel with the Japanese case, is the case of India. When India achieved its independence in 1948, the leaders of India were very different. The new leaders of India were very different from the people who attained the control in Japan after the Meiji Restoration. India and Japan are a fascinating comparison because they are both ancient civilizations with ancient cultures. You're not talking about backward lands. You're not talking about entering into virgin territory or anything like that. You've got old civilizations with old cultures, very similar in that respect. But the leaders the Gandhi, Nehru, the rest of the great leaders of India, had been raised in a British democratic tradition. They had been, they professed, and I'm sure were sincere, in believing that they wanted a democratic society with political freedom. And yet, what economic policies did they follow? Because they also had been raised and taught at the London School of Economics, where Bill Hutt, unfortunately, no longer was teaching. They had sat at the feet of Harold Laski, who was undoubtedly, by far and away, the most influential intellectual so far as India was concerned, just as Adam Smith was the most influential, in fact, so far as Japan was concerned. And they took it for granted, without even thinking about it, that the only way in which a modern society could go was in the direction of Fabian socialism, central planning, and collectivism. And as a result, whereas the Japanese leaders, who had no interest in democracy, produced an economic policy which generated democracy and fostered it, the Indians adopted an economic policy which has prevented democracy and has fostered a restrictive collectivist state. In both cases, they got results in the political area against their own ideas because they took over these economic ideas which were so much in the air. And of course, the consequences are very clear as well. Japan rose very rapidly, became a leading world power, grew by 1907 to a position in which he was able to defeat Russia in war. India has stagnated. Its people have not progressed, and it has remained a very backward, underdeveloped country. But that's not my main point. My point is rather the different one, to show how universal and widespread are these trends. That the collectivist trend was manifest in the Russian Revolution, it was manifest in the Communist Revolution in China, it was manifest in what happened in India. Now, in the past 20, 30, 40 years, there has been another change in the intellectual climate of opinion. Fabian socialism, the ideas of socialism, are really dead. You will not find, you will look long and hard before you find any intellectual who will tell you how collectivist organization is a way to get efficient production. It's a way to eliminate the wastes of competition and to assure that you get a high productivity and ample output. I don't think you can find anybody who will tell you that. I don't know, but any of you who have been in Britain, and you try to find an Englishman who will tell you the nationalized industries are the efficient industries, he'll be a very rare bird indeed, and when you find him, he'll probably be employed by one of those nationalized industries. At any rate, shortly after World War II, you started to have an intellectual trend the other way. Hayek's Road to Serfdom was probably one of the most important books that came along that helped that set of ideas along. Ayn Rand's novels had a very great influence. Those people who became complete and utter Randites were spoiled forever. But those people who were influenced by Rand but were able to return to their senses were much the better for it. She had a very great and I think a very good influence on the whole. I am not disparaging her influence. You had organizations like the Foundation for Economic Education spring up. You had the Mont Pelerin Society founded by Hayek in Switzerland in 1947. Originally, a small group of people who were isolated from their own intellectual communities and who met once a year so that they could spend a week in which they didn't have to think that they had to be careful about every word they said. That was part of the idea behind the Philadelphia Society in 1964, which Ed Fuller was talking about. The people who had the kind of ideas that those of us in this room represent today were very few and far between, were isolated in a few places. Many of them were the only one or two people at their institutions or their organizations who had the views they had. And the Philadelphia Society, like the Mont Pelerin Society, served an enormously important function in enabling them to get together and to get to know one another and to feel that maybe, after all, they weren't really such complete kooks as their colleagues had made them out to be. This has nothing to do with it, but I very well remember once when I came back from the founding meeting of the Mont Pelerin Society, and I was sitting around the table at the Quadrangle Club with various of my colleagues, one of whom at that time was Hans Morgenthau, the political scientist. And Hans asked me where I had been, and I told him, "Oh," he said, "you've been to a meeting of the veterans of the wars of the 19th century." I thought that was an excellent description. I don't know of any better description of the Mont Pelerin Society than that. But the point I want to make is really a different one. It is that what produced that intellectual trend? It was not generated by the intellectual attitude alone. In large part, it was generated, and it has been able to be effective and be widespread and adopted by the observable consequences of the welfare state, of the collectivist society that followed from the earlier intellectual trend. After all, the bright vision which the extreme form, communism, had held up, a vision which made it possible, it's hard to understand this now, but made it possible back in 1933-34, when the United States was at the depths of the Depression, for groups of intellectuals to support the Communist Party candidate for president. John Dos Passos, I believe, Arnold Bachman, in a recent article, he's here somewhere, had a list of the various people who signed that, and it's kind of shocking when you look at the list of the people who signed that. But at that time, here was the United States in deep depression, 20-25% of the population unemployed, a catastrophe of the most extreme kind. And here was this fresh new hope over there in Russia, communist society, centrally planned, the intellectuals were going to run it. And, of course, when American intellectuals went over there for a visit, they were shown one Potemkin village after another and came back very much impressed. That image, that hope, that dream has disappeared. There's nobody again today who will have a good word to say for communist Russia along the lines of building a society that will benefit the ordinary man. What you will have, people who are still collectivists say, "Oh, well, that's the wrong kind of communism. That was distorted by Stalin," or "it's the fact that you had this ancient Russian tradition of authoritarianism that made it impossible." But then, the other attempts at socialism, whether you take East Germany or Red China, none of them have served to fulfill those bright promises. It was that experience, more, I believe, than the ideas or abstract ideas of a von Mises or of a Hayek or of a Rand. It was that experience with what the actual results of a collectivist society that I think was responsible for the change in the intellectual climate of opinion. I've cited the most extreme example, but we come closer to home in the Western societies. Sweden was a great exemplar of the middle way. Never mind that it had escaped World War I and World War II. Never mind that it was saved from the Great Depression by German rearmament, which established a demand for Swedish steel. But it was the middle way, and it was showing how it was possible to combine a welfare state with individual freedom and with prosperity. But Sweden has been showing many, many strains in recent years. It's not anything like the kind of success story that it was some 5 or 10 years ago. Britain has been, of course, a more extreme case. But everywhere, wherever the welfare state was adopted, whether in the United States, whether in Britain, whether in Sweden, in France, the consequences was a growing role of government, higher and higher taxes, an unwillingness on the part of the public to finance the expenditures that the political process was generating, and as a result, inflation, a way of imposing taxes on people without anybody having to vote for it, an expedient to enable the government to finance a larger amount of spending by government than the public at large was willing to pay for. And everywhere, this combination of growing government expenditure and with many programs that were clearly failures, of inflation, and along with this, much against the ideas of the Phillips curve, of Keynesianism and so on, growing unemployment, these things became manifest everywhere, whether in Britain or in France, in Sweden or in the United States. And in my opinion, it has been this experience, more, as I say, than the abstract writings that predicted this experience, that has caused a dramatic change in the intellectual climate of opinion. And that change in the intellectual climate of opinion has again been worldwide. We tend to think of the change in the intellectual climate of opinion in terms of the election of Margaret Thatcher in Great Britain, or the election of Ronald Reagan in the United States. But it also explains solidarity in Poland. It is inconceivable that the solidarity movement, or a movement like solidarity, could have arisen in Poland 20 or 30 years ago, when the intellectual climate was so much more favorable to centralized control and collectivism. The same trend explains the kind of movements in Hungary, in Russia, in communist China, toward trying to introduce greater elements of market arrangements in their collectivist systems. It's all a response to the same intellectual opinion. It was earliest reflected in actual policy in that small collection of states in the Fertile Crescent of the Far East, Singapore, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Korea. The Gang of Four, that's what I was looking for. The Gang of Four countries, which have outpaced almost all other underdeveloped countries in terms of their rates of growth, and which have done so by largely, though by no means exclusively, following free market arrangements. Hong Kong has come closest to following a really free market arrangement, and it's in some ways the biggest paradox. Here is a dependency of Great Britain, of socialist, Fabian socialist Britain, at the height of the Fabian socialist state. And what does it do? By a series of accidents, it follows an Adam Smith policy, as close to it as any country in the world has followed. And that policy enables the population of Hong Kong to multiply close to tenfold in the post-war period, from about 500,000 just after the end of the war to over 5 million now. And at the same time, have a fourfold increase in the real income of the individual person on the island. One of the most extraordinary examples. Hong Kong is not a place where any of us would want to live, or most of us would want to live. It's not a place where most of the people in Hong Kong want to live. They would much prefer to come to the United States, there's no doubt about that. But the miracle is that with no resources, with nothing there, but what I would call good government, what Adam Smith would have called good government, what many social reformers of our earlier years would have called a callous neglect of social welfare, Hong Kong has been able to provide these people with a far better level of living than they were able to get by staying in communist China or by any of the other alternatives available to them. Taiwan had somewhat better circumstances, and it followed less of a free market policy. It had much more government intervention than Hong Kong. But it did extremely well. Given its better circumstances, it didn't do as well as Hong Kong did. But it did very well, and it followed largely free market policies. Singapore, the same thing is true. Korea, similar thing is true. As I say, none of them, Hong Kong comes the closest to being a pure case. The others are not. Singapore is a case of benevolent dictatorship. But this benevolent dictator adopted free market techniques and was very successful. I'm speaking, of course, of Lee Kuan Yew. But that, when you come to the West and you go away from there, the free market ideas, this change in ideas, has been manifested in Great Britain. As I've already indicated, it was manifested there by the election of Margaret Thatcher. It may appear that the election of Mitterrand is a contradiction to the thesis I'm now expressing, and to some extent it is. But it's very far from being a complete contradiction. Mitterrand's talk today is very different from what Mitterrand's talk would have been 10 or 20 years ago. And moreover, Mitterrand's policies are very different. He started out with a straight socialist policy. And whereas typically and historically, a policy of big government spending, of inflating the money supply, of holding down wages and prices, has typically worked for about a year until people caught on to it, when it has been catastrophic. As I said earlier, when that kind of a trend gets underway, it's very unclear where it's going to go, and you always have an interim period of great uncertainty. You had such an interim period in the United States around the time of the New Deal when we were moving into a new pattern. It took some time before it straightened out. And I believe that many of the uncertainties that are so much with us today around the world, expressed in the fears that people have that there's going to be a financial collapse and the banks of the world are going to collapse, in the doomsayers who say the Kondratiev's third wave is about to break on our backs and drive us into the depths of depression. That kind of uncertainty, I think, really reflects the fact that we are in one of these in-between interim periods when one trend has ended and another trend has not yet emerged. I think the change in philosophical ideas is clear, that the episode of Fabian socialism is over. The episode of the real welfare state is over. What's very unclear is where we're going to go from here. And I don't believe that you can give a single answer to that. I think that's still in the laps of the gods. I think a very likely answer for countries like the United States and Great Britain, and that's the title I suggested to Don for this talk today, is that we will move toward a limping welfare state. What I mean by that is that those of us who would like to see us move toward a far greater degree of market freedom, toward eliminating almost all of these welfare state approaches, we're not going to get our way. When you have a change in trend, you never go back to where you were before. You go in a new direction, and you carry with you a lot of the debris from the period you've been through. So unfortunately, we're not going to be able to do what we should do, which is to abolish Social Security and replace it by a more sensible voluntary system. Get rid of all of these government measures. After all, the test can be expressed in terms of government spending as a fraction of income. At the height of Britain's prosperity at the end of the 19th century, government spending in Britain was 10% of the national income. In 1928, in the United States, government spending was about 10% of the national income. The church has always been in favor of a tithe. It's clear to me that 10% is the right proportion of the national income to be spent by government. We are now spending something over 40% of the national income. And I am very skeptical that we will be able to cut that down to the right 10%. So when I say we're going to go into a limping welfare state as one real possibility, I think we are moving to cut down the role of government. Despite the twists and the turns, the backlashes and the forward movements, I think the trend will be to cut down the role of government. But it will not be to eliminate all of these programs. We will continue to have them with us. And we will have, that is, a reduced and limping welfare state. But fortunately, we have the heritage of our long period of essentially unrestrained market economies. And we can stand a good deal of waste. Adam Smith, you know, once said there's a deal of ruin in a nation. And there is a deal of ruin. So we can stand a lot of waste, and I think that we can carry this load, and if we can open up the markets, give the markets greater opportunity to greater role, put a lid on government spending and gradually bring it down, not to 10%, but maybe to 30, 35%, then we can have a period of very great economic prosperity and of very great political freedom and diversity. But I don't think that's the only possibility. And if you want to look at the other possibilities, you look at the growth of the other possibility, it seems to me, the other major possibility, is going all the way to a complete totalitarian society. The kind of thing that seems to be in process in Central and South America. Kind of thing that's going on in Nicaragua. The kind of thing that has been spreading like a plague through so much of the world. The whole Russian Empire, wherever it goes. Now, that's not really a product of the Fabian socialist trend. It harks back to a much earlier set of attitudes of authoritarian control from a small elite group at the center. But unfortunately, that seems to me to be the next most likely development. The one thing I feel sure you will not have is simply a continuation of the way things have been going. You will not have a welfare state a la Britain, a la the 1970s in the United States. You will either cut it back and open up the greater role of government, which I hope we will have, or you will move in the totalitarian direction. It's very hard to predict when these things are going to happen or what back and forth fills there will be. Many of us had great hopes that 1980 marked the real turning point. Those hopes may still be fulfilled. It's not too late. But at the moment, they don't look as bright as they did a couple of years ago. But if they aren't fulfilled, you've got to take some perspective. We've been in this fight for a long time. We've had disappointments before. There are those of us who had high hopes when a Mr. Richard Nixon was elected to office. Those hopes were disappointed. And people at that time thought the disappointment was forever. But it wasn't. And we had another chance in 1980. I hope this one will be a more successful case. But if it isn't, we'll have another chance again. Some of us may not be around to see it. But most of you in this room will be. Because the thing that gives me optimism is that the public at large in the United States has clearly changed its attitudes. You do have people objecting to the elimination of government programs from which they directly benefit. But you go around and nobody objects to the proposition that government is too big, too pervasive, and ought to be cut down. It's only they want to do it at somebody else's expense, which is perfectly natural. That's why it seems to me the right way to move is a way that Lou and the others have been moving in the direction of trying to package these things together in a package and try to make a combined deal whereby you give up some of yours, if I give up some of mine, if he gives up some of his. That's the route which is possible. You know, there have been some very interesting studies of referenda versus legislative action. And they show that referenda are almost invariably more fiscally conservative and more libertarian than legislative action. Here in the state of California, now California has a reputation as being a very liberal state. It is. It has had a very liberal governor. The state legislature has not been dependable. But the people of California have been much more sensible and dependable. They have eliminated by their votes the inheritance tax in the state of California. They voted this year on the various issues. They voted against the gun control bill. They voted against the bottle bill. On the whole, and what's true in California is true in other states around the country. There have been many states in recent years that have had referenda on increasing the introducing a graduated income tax or increasing its productivity. Those have almost invariably been voted down. Now, this is fundamentally a democracy, and although there's many a slip twixt the opinion of the public at large and what Congress and the legislatures do, ultimately, Congress and the legislatures are going to be dominated by what the public at large wants. And that's why I feel very confident that sooner or later in this country, the public opinion will be affected, and we will succeed in moving toward that limping welfare state, which may not be the ideal state to which we would like to go, but would be a lot better than where we've been heading up till now. Thank you.